From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, bringing Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility to the screen, we talk with film director Ang Lee. His two previous films, The Wedding Banquet and Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, were Academy Award nominees for Best Foreign Film. Also, we talk with Lawrence Block. He's best known for his mystery novels featuring private investigator Matthew Scudder. Block started out writing short stories for men's magazines like Manhunt. His early crime novels from the 60s are being republished. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Oliver Stone's Nixon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ang Lee, directed the new film adaptation of Jane Austen's novel Sense and Sensibility. Set in 19th century England, the story is part social satire, part romance. It revolves around two sisters who hope to find men to marry. The younger sister, Marianne, played by Kate Winslet, is a romantic. The other, Eleanor, played by Emma Thompson, is more reserved and believes in upholding the social code at all costs. In this scene, Marianne has just said goodbye to Mr. Willoughby, whom she believes is the man of her dreams. He shares her romantic nature and her love of poetry. Eleanor thinks Marianne should show more restraint.
Good work, Marianne. You've covered Shakespeare, Scott, all forms of poetry. Another meeting will ascertain his views on nature and romantic attachments, and then you will have nothing left to talk about, and the relationship will be over.
I suppose I have erred against decorum. I should have been dull and spiritless and talked only of the weather or the state of the roads.
No, but Mr. Willoughby can be in no doubt of your enthusiasm for him.
Why should he doubt it? Why should I hide my regard?
No particular reason, only that we know so little of him.
But time alone does not determine intimacy. 7 years would be insufficient to make some people acquainted with each other, and 7 days can be more than enough for others.
Or 7 hours in this case.
The setting of Sense and Sensibility was new territory for director Ang Lee. He grew up in Taiwan and first came to the States to attend college. Two of his previous films, The Wedding Banquet and Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, were Academy Award nominees for Best Foreign Film. I asked him if he was surprised when the producers of Sense and Sensibility asked him, an Asian American man, to direct a film about 19th century English women.
Yes, I was very surprised. I think they're crazy. When I first received the script, which is, I think, last September when I was doing a European tour to promote Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, but I saw Emma Thompson's name on the cover. I was very confused because they cannot be ridiculous with Emma's name. I just assumed she's attached to play Eleanor. In the script, so I just kept reading it. About halfway, it started to make sense to me. The subject matter is very much what I did before. And not only that, but the tune of the project, which is combining cynical social satire, funny on one side, with, on the other side, the warm, sincere family drama and being romantic, usually these two doesn't get along. So I'm the kind of filmmaker to do that. So it felt as if it's a call of destiny that I couldn't help but being attracted to the project. Of course, I have to overcome the culture barrier, which is brave for me and brave for the producers.
Had you ever read any of Jane Austen's books?
Shamefully, no. I grew up in Taiwan. I always saw Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen on the bookshelf in the bookstores. But I just assumed that's for the girls. I never picked them up.
So did you read Sense and Sensibility before making the movie?
Yes, of course. After I decided to take the job, I read the book. And as I said, I felt very much of destiny. That for all this time I was at Jane Austen, without knowing it.
Now, I know that you think of 18th century England as being, you know, a foreign culture to you. I think of it as being a foreign culture to me also.
And that's why I did it. I think it's safer than to do a contemporary American piece.
Really?
It is a foreign film. Nobody has seen it. My guess is as good as anybody's guess.
Right, right. Well, that's an interesting point. That's true. That's
and true. Because it's foreign to us, because it's a period piece, you allow those abstract emotion and story to happen. I think that's the benefit, actually, to me.
Now, what did you want to bring out of the natural beauty of the countryside in England, where most of Sense and Sensibility is set?
Just shoot them. That's so beautiful.
Isn't that what you had to do?
Pretty much. The only thing I add artificially, I think, is to frame in such a way that every frame has a sense of sense and sensibility, which I think is a very important dialectic aspect of the project. The lines, the emphasis on the English landscape, which is artificial way to bring nature to life. It's very period thought, spirit, the builder's landscape. So those lines are very, very tamed, but very emotional. The color I use, the green and the gray-white, I think is very, and the use of cloud has some sense of emotion, sensibility, and also the straight of the line and the tame shows a lot of sense. If there is anything I put into it, that's that aspect.
Now, Emma Thompson wrote the screenplay, the adaptation for Sense and Sensibility. Did she write it for herself? Did she assume that she was going to play the older sister?
I don't know. That's a secret only she knows. I just assume she's attached to the project. I was very surprised when she said I didn't have to cast her, and I have to ask her to play it. But as soon as I asked, she couldn't wait to jump in. I mean, I wrote the lead part according to myself in my first two scripts. That's just nature. I think she wrote a perfect Emma Thompson role. Emma is Eleanor. Maybe there's a consideration of age. Well, I think she really wants to be a writer when she wrote the script. It's not necessarily she's attached, but I think she put herself in Eleanor a lot.
Well, you mentioned the age thing. I think Emma Thompson's about 36, and in the novel, the character's 19. I think in the screenplay, she's more like 27.
Yeah.
But did that concern you, that Emma Thompson is, you know, considerably older than the character's supposed to be?
Of course. Not only because she's older, but a lot more sophisticated than Eleanor. I just hope that the difference between the two sisters in terms of sense and sensibility is by nature, not by age, not because somebody older, so she's more sensible. So the most work I work together in portraying this part is playing younger. She has no problem playing complex scene, difficult scenes. She can do in a second. Plus, she wrote the script, she really knows the material backwards. So the real task is a lot of moments she has to play very innocently, very young, very fresh, intuitively. So that was the biggest job. We do a lot of exercise to de-sophisticate her.
What kind of exercises would you do to de-sophisticate her?
Breathing, meditating.
How does breathing and meditating help with that?
Well, just reduce tension and more focus on who she is, I mean, who she's playing. And also a lot of movement, let's say walking like Eleanor. We create a baby-like walking. In the first 15 minutes of the movie, I was very careful not to give her close-ups except candlelights to let audience get used to she being Eleanor. Once audience take her as Eleanor, she has no problem in playing because she's a great actress. No, lighting helps, but that's small help. The biggest has to come from her acting. I wouldn't let her voice go down certain pitches because when she's going, pitches go deeper, she sounds older and more mature. And just keep reminding her. She's very good at that. When you remind her once, she never forgets. Once she's into that character, like 10, 15 minutes into the movie, I think she can do whatever she wants.
Emma Thompson published some of the diary that she kept while you were all making Sense and Sensibility. And she writes in that diary, "I've learned that Hugh Grant and I caused Ang Lee great suffering the other day. He has never had any actor question anything before. In Taiwan, the director holds complete sway. He speaks and everybody obeys. Here, actors always question and make suggestions." Does that ring true to you?
The first day. I was very shocked.
What did they say? What did they challenge that was so shocking?
Well, that's a shot I thought I perfectly mapped out with them walking through the English landscape, which is very Sense and Sensibility. It's an artificial way to bring nature to their garden, to their life, and they're a sensible person. The way they fall in love is very remote. It doesn't really sweep you over until the end. So, you know, I decided to put them way back in the garden. And they got a little freaked out the first day of shooting. I think at first they thought I didn't get the joke, which it is a joke, but I don't need them to speak to the camera. I would rather like to shoot from the side and from their back. So there was some argument there. After that, we had a very good heart-to-heart conversation. And we both understand each other, and things start to go smoother and smoother every day.
Now, Emma Thompson also wrote, "Aang's style of leadership is somehow to draw us all to him silently and wait for things to happen. He has the shape of the shots in his head and always will stand for silent minutes on end, thinking through the flow of the scenes to see if what we're doing will fit his vision. I find it very inspiring, but it's quite different to being told what to do." Did you think that your more introspective, silent approach to directing was throwing off some of the actors?
That's my nature. I love making movies, but my nature is such, sometimes maybe not the most efficient as a director, but somehow I get it done. I think that's how I get it done. I in this subject especially, in this project, I think I'm more playing as a seducer. I try to seduce the most out of them and take it from there and then decide what's the best for the movie. And very much put ego aside and first talk to them and see what they see, how they want to play.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there are shots I had in my head previously. But some of the scenes, more talking scenes, I wouldn't mind to do some of the dilemma of rehearsing argument, then see what material I have in mind. That's always how I see movie making should be done. It's not really a dictatorship, but the movie should have a life of its own. And as a director, you observe what you have in hand, what the life, the organic approach should be. So it's not, you don't always know what exactly you're doing, and I don't hide that fact. You know, as a director, sometimes you have to hide that you don't know what you're doing and make a quick decision, tell people what to do. The result could be end up quite stupidly. You can make stupid decisions. So, you know, sometimes I lose a little face and let it go a little chaotic and see what's the best way to do, to make the movie.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ang Lee, and he directed the new movie Sense and Sensibility. He also wrote and directed The Wedding Banquet and Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. Let's take a short break, and then I'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ang Lee, the director of Sense and Sensibility, and also the writer and director of The Wedding Banquet and Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. You grew up in Taiwan. Was your family very traditional?
Very much so.
So what were some of the traditional values that were important in your family?
It was very male-centered.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of honors.
A lot of what? Honors?
Yeah, honors. My father was from China. His family was demolished by communists, and I was the first son he has in Taiwan. So there's a great sense of honor and family tradition. The family name should go on very much on my shoulder. So a lot of that.
Now, what are some of the other responsibilities that come with being the first son?
Well, I have some more sons, of course, to continue the family name. Being a respectable man, so to honor your family. I think that's the most important thing.
Was your idea of what you needed to do to honor your family different from what your parents expected you to do to honor them?
Yeah, for me, the honorable thing to do with your life is do whatever you do best and do your best towards that. To me, it's to make funny movies, which is not exactly their idea of an honorable thing to begin with.
So was there a difficult period for you when you decided to pursue what you wanted to do instead of obeying your parents?
I do the same thing as I do with this project. I keep quiet and have things coming my way. As long as time is long enough, I just persistently do what I do.
Well, it probably helped that you left Taiwan for the United States to go to college and then to study filmmaking in graduate school at NYU. I mean, that was that distance helpful
to
you?
Yeah, far out of their reach, yes. But, you know, they still call, they still write letters, at times visit me, like the wedding banquet. There's no escape.
Well, yeah, no, the wedding banquet is an interesting story. In the wedding banquet, a young Chinese man now living in America is expecting a visit from his father. But this young man is gay. And, you know, his lover is another man, and he doesn't want his father to know that. So he kind of stages a wedding with a woman, so his father will think that he's straight. And, of course, the wedding turns into this really elaborate wedding. Was there any equivalent situation that you faced where you had to fake something or stage something because of a parental visit?
Well, that was my friend's story. I put a lot of me. I pretty much portrayed the leading character to my own nature. Is always try not to offend anyone, try to loyal to the family. My version of wedding was in the marriage bureau. There's a lousy marriage scene in the movie that was mine. My mother was crying, thinking it's such a sham. I didn't have a wedding banquet. She just embraced my wife and cried, hug her, and say, sorry, we didn't give you such a shabby wedding. That was my version. I have to put up a wedding banquet, which I see over and over again in my lifetime through everybody's wedding.
No, so what was your mother unhappy about?
I didn't give them a wedding banquet. They came to visit me from Taiwan, and I married in a marriage bureau in City Hall.
Oh.
Yeah, with a group of exotic people.
No, how did you feel about not doing the big wedding banquet, knowing it would break your parents' hearts?
Somehow I just have a cynical view of wedding banquet. I think it's a social ritual. It has nothing to do with your marriage, but it's a social statement. But people take it so sincerely. At that time, I was busy with my thesis film. I just couldn't cope with that. I just thought, no, just get over with. My wife was fine with that. And I know they're probably not being thrilled by that. I didn't know they totally break down. So I have a lot of guilty feeling.
You still have guilty feeling?
Yeah. I think the making of Wedding Banquet, the movie, sort of an amendment for that feeling.
Well, what did your parents think of the film?
I think they loved the movie. Yeah, they see a lot of themselves in the movie. I pretty much portray the parents like my own parents.
Now, you know, a lot of people would go ahead and have the big wedding, even though they didn't want to, just to please their parents or just to make sure that their parents weren't offended. And I think it's a very difficult decision to make.
Yeah, it's oldest son in the family. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you decide that you'd let them just deal with it, that you weren't going to do something that wasn't true to yourself just to please them? Especially, I mean, coming from such a traditional family where, you know, piety is so important.
I guess I stayed in New York too long. I decided to be a rebellion against it. But once you do that, you feel sorry what you did. Because I do that very rarely. I was a very obedient child growing up. I'm still is.
Oh, so maybe you were just kind of rebelling against your own obedience.
Yes. That's one of the rare times that I do that.
Do you think you're finding a place for yourself in Hollywood? How much do you want to be the independent filmmaker, and how much would you like to do more assignment type of films like Sense and Sensibility?
Depends what moves me. I think I will still develop most of my material in the future. But if something like Sensibility come my way, if I'm moved, if I can find a connection between the material and the most sincere, deepest emotion I have, and then I will do it. In terms of Hollywood, I hope I can be free from that. Should I need Hollywood support to do certain things, I engage into that machine, but still try to find the maximum of freedom. And I might even use that money to do independent work. I hope I have a freedom to do any size of movie, as long as the size of the budget is best for the project.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ang Lee directed the new film Sense and Sensibility. He also wrote and directed The Wedding Banquet, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, and Pushing Hands. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with mystery writer Lawrence Block about creating his series featuring the private eye Matthew Scudder. We'll also talk about Block's early crime novels from the 60s, which are being republished. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Oliver Stone's Nixon. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I've spent a lot of vacation time with private investigator Matthew Scudder. What I mean is, I often pick up Scudder novels on my time off. Scudder is the creation of mystery writer Lawrence Block, who many mystery readers consider one of the best in the field. Block started the Scudder series in the mid-70s. His early crime fiction, from the 60s, is being republished by Carolyn Graff. Block finished his latest Scudder novel about a week ago, but that won't be out for a while. His 12th Scudder book, A Long Line of Dead Men, will be published in paperback in February. Let's start with a short reading from that book, which will give you a sense of who Scudder is. Scudder's life has changed since the series began. He started as a heavy drinker. About halfway through the series, he joined AA. He used to be a loner. Now he's in a committed relationship with a former prostitute named Elaine, who recently used her savings to open a Manhattan gallery.
When we met, I was a cop with a brand new gold shield in my pocket and a wife and two sons in Syosset, and she was a young call girl, bright and funny and beautiful. We made each other happy for a few years, and then I drank my way out of my marriage in the police department, and we pretty much lost track of each other. She went on doing what she'd been doing, saving her money and investing in real estate, keeping fit at the health club, stretching her mind in night school. A couple of years ago, circumstances threw us together again, and what we'd had was still there, stronger than ever and richer for the years we'd lived through. At first, she went on seeing clients, and we both pretended that was okay, but of course it wasn't. And eventually I bit the bullet and said so, and she admitted she'd already put herself out of business. We kept inching closer and closer to marriage. Last April, she'd sold her old place on East 50th and picked out an apartment in the Park Vendome, and we'd moved in together. It was her money that bought the place, and I'd refused to let her put my name on the deed. I paid the monthly maintenance on the apartment and picked up the checks when we went out to dinner. She covered the household expenses. Eventually, we would put all our money together, but we hadn't gotten around to that yet. Eventually, we would get married, too, and I wasn't sure why it was taking us so long. We kept not setting a date. We kept letting it slide.
Lawrence Block, you once described yourself as writing the episodic biography of someone who doesn't really exist, a description I quite like. Tell us more where you see Matthew Scudder, your private detective, in his life now. At what point is he in his life? I mean, he's 55 years old.
Yeah, he's 55 years old, and his life keeps changing. And that's what's made the book so interesting for me. That's why I've been able to write them for as long as I have, I think, because I quite honestly don't know what Scudder's going to do next.
I read your books in part for the atmosphere. The mood of the character, the mood of the situations you've created. I mean, Scudder is somebody who wants something he can't have, alcohol. He deals both with the meaning and the meaninglessness of life. He's very good at what he does, but he has very little to show for it in terms of financial reward or material gain. And that doesn't often bother him, but it sometimes does. And he's a guy who stands back from the world and looks at it and tries to figure it out. This is an atmosphere that I find very appealing. What kind of atmosphere do you want to create? What kind of mood do you want your Scudder books to have?
I don't know exactly. I suppose in a certain way I write the books to find out. I'll start out with a plot idea, and I don't really know what state of mind of Scudder's is going to be reflected. I don't know what the moods are going to be. That develops very much as the book goes along.
The mood of some of the Scudder books were so dependent on his drinking and then later on his not drinking yet wanting to, and his loneliness. And now I think he's got his drinking pretty well in check. I mean, yeah, he still wants a drink and he still goes to AA meetings, but it doesn't constantly gnaw at him in the same way that it did. And he's got his loneliness in check. I mean, he's in it for the long haul with Elaine. So are you having to find other things for him to deal with?
There's always the danger in a series, if you let it evolve organically, that eventually you're going to write yourself out of a job.
Right.
And I thought that it happened with 8 Million Ways to Die when he stopped drinking. I thought that that exhausted the character as a character. And it did for a couple of years. I was a little while between books there. And then I discovered that for Scudder, as well as for people in the real world, there is life after sobriety. And I think there's also a similar danger now, in that he is in a stable relationship, and he seems to have, if not solved, then outlasted most of the major problems in his life. So that is part of the challenge, is to find a way that he can still be involved in a compelling story, even given this change in his circumstances.
You know, when Scudder stopped drinking and he started drinking a whole lot of coffee, you know, because he'd be at AA meetings drinking coffee and he'd go to bars with friends and not drink alcohol but drink lots of coffee, I started thinking, gee, shouldn't he have, like, reflux by now, or some kind of terrible acid indigestion type of problem? And sure enough, I think he's been drinking more, like, club soda and Perrier lately. But it occurred to me, you know, this is so typical of life. You know, like, you give up a horrible habit like alcohol, and you substitute something that should be okay like coffee.
Right. Something's going to get you.
Yeah, and then the coffee starts to get you. Then, like, even the coffee becomes a habit that you have to give
right.
up.
Right, right. Well, I don't think he has any troubles with coffee. There is the question as to what's going to happen with his extra relationship dalliance with Lisa Holtzman. That's certainly a question. A lot of people wrote in about that. They said he finally stopped drinking and now he's running around on a lane. I don't like this.
That's right. He's seeing somebody who he met in a previous novel, he was investigating her husband's murder. And two of your novels have ended in big question marks, you know, about whether he's going to continue to pursue that relationship.
Sure.
Why did you put him in a long-term relationship with Elaine, a former prostitute?
Well, it just sort of grew. I didn't have the intention of that either. You know, Elaine is in the books from the very first one. She appears in The Sins of the Fathers and just in a cameo appearance. And then in the eighth book, A Ticket to the Boneyard, that's when they get back together again. And I just really liked the way they were together in that book. And I don't know. It seemed right. I couldn't break them up after that.
Lawrence Block is my guest, and he's an author of many books, including the Matthew Scudder Private Eye series, and the latest in that series is called A Long Line of Dead Men. The first books you wrote under pen names.
Yes.
Why were they pen names?
Well, the books were trash.
What was trash about them?
Just about everything. I'm sustained, Terry, by the knowledge that these books were not printed on acid-free paper.
How many years has it been? They probably still exist, right?
they probably do. People bring them up to me at signings expecting me to sign them. I say, sign it, I won't touch it. You know, get away from me.
So you knew then that you didn't like what you were writing, but it was good experience and you can make a book?
It was good experience. It was a good paid apprenticeship.
And these were what, crime novels?
No. These were, I guess now you would call them softcore porn.
How'd you break into that market?
It's hard to remember. Actually, it shouldn't be hard to remember because I am writing a memoir about those days. But it was, my agent suggested that I try one for that market. I had an agent at that point, and I did. The market was just beginning to exist, so I was one of the first people doing it. This was in, like, the late 50s.
What were the boundaries that you had to write within? What would have been going too far?
Well, you couldn't use four-letter words.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't be terribly graphic.
And did there have to be a sturdy plot to rest the sex scenes on so it would look like a real novel?
No, there had to be the illusion of a plot, but there had to be a lot of incident. And it was wonderful training ground because it was an extremely forgiving medium, as you can imagine, because as long as it was sufficiently erotic and the story kept moving, it didn't really matter if there were vast holes in the plot or anything of the sort. So I learned a lot doing it.
I imagine this helped you write with inhibition also. I mean, without inhibition, because you weren't using your name. So you could try anything without people...
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Holding you accountable.
very true.
I think that's a hard thing for young writers. You're so self-conscious that this isn't good enough and so-and-so isn't going to like this and what if this gets a bad review?
That's right. That's right. I hadn't even particularly thought of that, but it was very liberating in that respect.
Was it liberating, too, to be writing sexual scenes?
I think so. You know, I was like 20 years old at the time. So it was science fiction in a sense for me.
Now, did the covers have illustrations that gave the promise of more than you were going to actually deliver?
Oh, no, I delivered. I delivered. Nobody ever brought the book back for a refund.
What were the covers like?
The covers, actually, and some of them have become extremely collectible because some of these cover artists are treasured by people, paperback collectors who are interested in that sort of thing.
So I know you have not revealed the pen names that you've written under, but you say you're writing a memoir about that period. Will you reveal it in your memoir?
I will. I will tell all.
Wow. How come? After all these years of
I
not telling.
I don't know.
You're a pretty intuitive guy. I mean, you just apparently don't sit back and really brood a lot about what to do. It sounds like you either do it or you don't do it.
I brood a lot, and then I either do it or I don't do it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. My guest is mystery writer Lawrence Block. He writes the Matthew Scudder Private Eye series. Block was named 1994 Grand Master of the Mystery Writers of America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is mystery writer Lawrence Block. His crime fiction from the 60s is being republished. Here's a reading from one of those early novels. It's called After the First Death. It begins with a man waking up naked on a bed in a strange room. He has no idea how he's gotten there. Maybe he's coming out of a drunken stupor. Maybe it's something worse. All that he's sure of is he's in pain and he's in trouble.
I sat up on the bed and looked around. I started to get up. And there was something on the floor, something sticky that my feet touched. Wet and sticky. I closed my eyes. A shiver went through me, a chill caused by more than the cold and my own nakedness. I kept my eyes closed and folded my arms foolishly across my chest. I did not want to look. I did not want to know. I wanted to go to sleep and stay asleep for ages and wake up elsewhere, miles and years away. I wondered, briefly, if it was a dream. I opened my eyes again. I picked up one foot and looked hopelessly at the bottom of it. Blood. I tried to catch my breath and somehow couldn't, and I looked at the floor, and the nausea came back again in a flood with no warning. I threw up with the spontaneity of the knee-jerk reflex. It was that automatic. I looked, I saw, I vomited. I thought of the way I had reached across the floor as if it were a sea in which I dared not set foot. An apt image. The floor was a sea of blood. A body floated upon this ocean. A girl, black hair, staring blue eyes, bloodless lips. Naked. Dead. Her throat slashed deeply. It had to be a dream. It had to be a dream. It was not a dream. It was not a dream at all. I've done it again, I thought. Sweet Jesus, I've done it again.
What is he afraid he's done again?
Killed a woman in a drunken blackout.
Take us back to 1969. Do you remember writing this book and how you came up with the story and what you were going for?
Yes. Let me see. I think I wrote the book in 67, I think. I I got the idea of a person who had managed to get himself out of prison on the strength of one of the recent Supreme Court rulings on inadmissibility of confessions or something like that. And I thought that it would be interesting if such a person found himself committing the same crime again, but became aware of that he hadn't really done it, that he'd been framed this time. And then, of course, presumes that perhaps he was framed the first time, too, and this has a great incentive, on the one hand, to avoid capture, and on the other, to solve the crime.
It seems to me you must have been living in two really different worlds, you know, the world that you lived in, and then the world that you wrote about, a world in which people are framed all the time, and people are murdered all the time, and... you know, that crime world of fiction that so many, you know, movies and novels and TV shows are set in.
Right. Well, that's not difficult to enter by simply exploiting one's own innate paranoia. But in this particular book, I was quite familiar with the Times Square scene that I've described here. That was something I knew well at the time.
Why did you know it well?
Oh, because I hung out there a lot.
Uh-huh. What brought you there?
Oh, personal yearnings. Corrupt motives.
Okay. Do you care to elaborate, or do you want to leave it at that?
I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Now, how did you start the Matthew Scudder Private Eye series? After writing a lot of books that weren't part of a series in which there were no
sure.
recurring characters.
Sure. The Scudder series, unlike some other series that I've found myself doing, was conceived as a series. I set out to write a group of books about this character, and I had the character figured out and the publisher in line for this before I wrote the first book. So it was conceived as a series. What was not conceived was the idea that Scudder would change from one book to another.
Why did you make him an alcoholic?
Oh, he was just that from the beginning. I don't know exactly.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk about the way the series changes, I say sometimes that, you know, in 8 Million Ways to Die, he surprised me by getting sober, and that actually I had no idea he had a problem.
Is that true?
No, I knew he had a problem. That was part of it, that he was, a heavy alcoholic drinker from the early books on, that and the angst-ridden and guilt-ridden nature of the man.
Is Matthew Scudder's drinking based on first-hand experience that you had of drinking?
Well, Scudder and I were different kinds of drinkers, I think, in certain respects. But without getting into this too much, I can say that he and I both used to drink, and neither of us does now.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you something I've been trying to figure out about you.
Okay.
Okay. you know, the mood in the Scudder books, which I so like, is so... It's often so kind of, you know, gloomy. And I mean, there's a murder that he's trying to solve and a drink that he wants to have and he can't. And, you know, there's... It's all these, like, yearnings that are going to go unsatisfied in one way or another. And I get your newsletter. You actually have your own newsletter that updates your readers about, you know, your latest books and where you're going to give a reading and stuff. Your newsletter is so upbeat. It's kind of like, you know, dear readers, feeling great.
You know? Well, you wouldn't want to get a newsletter from Scudder, for God's sake.
Well, I probably would, you know. But you know, I'm trying to figure out, now, how is Lawrence Block so kind of, like, feeling good and upbeat and able to write, you know, this real downbeat kind of series? Like, where do those two connect, you know?
You know, there's one's me and the other's the character, I suppose.
Yeah, but you created the character. I mean, he came from you.
True. True. There was a wonderful story told about Morris Karnofsky, the actor in the Yiddish theater, who auditioned for a Shakespearean role. And he came on, and he talked and introduced himself and everything with a thick accent. And they were giggling hysterically at the thought of him auditioning for Shakespeare. And then they said, all right, well, do the scene, Mr. Karnofsky. And he said, now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by the sun of York. And you know, a flawless reading. And they were stunned. And they weren't familiar with his work. And they said, you know, how, Mr. Karnofsky, there's something we have to ask you. It seems so remarkable. And he said, what do you mean? He said, oh, he said, you mean the accent? He said, I'm an actor. You know, I'm an actor. And I love that story. And I think that applies here. The books are darker than I am. I'm a writer.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, this was a treat.
Lawrence Block's latest Matthew Scudder book, A Long Line of Dead Men, will be published in paperback in February. He also writes a series of comic novels about burglar Bernie Rodenbar. This is Fresh Air. Writer-director Oliver Stone has been keeping up a pace worthy of Woody Allen. He made Heaven and Earth in 1993, Natural Born Killers in 1994, and this year, the 3-hour and 10-minute Nixon, starring Anthony Hopkins as the 37th president. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
When you hear that Oliver Stone has made a movie about Nixon, you can easily imagine the kind of slash-and-burn job he might do. So it's surprising how humane and even-handed Stone's film turns out to be. When he makes a movie about his heroes, as in Born on the 4th of July, Stone can be simple-minded and even syrupy. But when he takes on a monstrous character like Nixon, something magical happens. The bullying force of Stone's storytelling is filtered through a real curiosity about human complexity, and the result is amazingly fresh and vivid. Nixon begins in 1973, as the nets of Watergate are closing in. The president, played by Anthony Hopkins, sits in the Lincoln Room, drinking, taking pills, listening to the notorious tapes, and remembering. The movie is constructed as a raucous series of flashbacks and flash-forwards, but everywhere you expect it to go wrong, Stone manages to be surprisingly restrained. Even Nixon's famously humiliating courtship of his wife, Pat, who's brilliantly played by Joan Allen, is remarkably understated. The movie's portraits of their marriage are among Stone's finest scenes. Take this one, for instance, in which Nixon's handlers have just convinced him to run for president, and now he has to convince his reluctant wife.
Buddy?
Should be going. The primaries are soon, aren't they? New Hampshire.
I love you, buddy. I need you.
I don't want them to love me.
But I need you out there. It won't be like the last time. The wars crippled the Democrats. I can win. We deserve it. It's ours, buddy. At last. Nobody knows that better than you. Frank Nixon's boy. Do you remember what Mom said? We're not like other people. We don't choose our way. We can really change things, buddy. We got a chance to get it right. We can change America.
Nixon the movie works rather the way an opera does. We already know the story, so Stone doesn't really bother telling it. He's looking for emotion, for the key moments that define or reveal his protagonist's psychology. It's hard to imagine what this movie will feel like to people who didn't live through the Nixon years. They'll probably find it utterly bewildering, because the film plays like a kind of hallucinatory historical pageant, a fever dream. The multimedia techniques that Stone has been developing in JFK and Natural Born Killers, with lots of different film stocks and juxtapositions of imagery, become a full-blown mature style here. In fact, Stone may now be the most adventurous movie stylist in America. At times, like most Stone films, this one is overbearing. It's studded with references to Citizen Kane, for instance. But as presumptuous as that may sound, what Stone is trying to do is establish an interesting idea, that just as William Randolph Hearst, on whom Citizen Kane was based, was the quintessential American for the first half of the century, so Nixon was for the second, a middle American nobody who became a success by sheer force of will, and who never stopped believing that in the great American game of class, wealth, and sex appeal, the cards were hopelessly stacked against him. Anthony Hopkins doesn't look or sound like Richard Nixon, but 15 minutes into the film, you don't care. Hopkins captures the man's pride and his self-loathing, his vengefulness and his need to do good, his lust for the limelight and his terror of it. And all around Hopkins are remarkable actors doing impressions of familiar figures, especially Paul Sorvino, whose Henry Kissinger is an extraordinary combination of coercion and sycophancy. What the movie never captures is the Nixon who was the most powerful leader in the world, the canny administrator who ran a government, a party, and an entire country. Even his foreign policy breakthroughs, like the opening of the door to China, are played as mad scenes. But then, there's always too much madness in Oliver Stone's movies, in spite of which, he's managed to turn the tragedy of Richard Nixon into one of the most impressive films of the year.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landau. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shura directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Farrar, Straus & Giroux, publisher of Sophie's World, a novel about the history of philosophy. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.